With midnight screams, a million letters in between.
Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. I'm your host, and I'm joined by our resident expert for a real deep dive today.
Hi, everyone. Yeah, I am really excited to get into this one. It's a massive topic.
It really is. I mean, usually a medical diagnosis is kind of like engineering, right? You break your arm, the x-ray shows a jagged white line, and the doctor just points at the film and says, well, there it is. That's the problem.
Right. It's a purely binary system. The bone is broken or it is not broken. It's clean. It's highly visible. And psychologically, you know, that absolute certainty is incredibly comforting for a patient.
Exactly. But today, we are stepping into the world of human genomics and massive national DNA sequencing programs, where that x-ray machine is just completely obsolete. Imagine taking a test that tells you your seemingly healthy newborn baby might develop a complex, debilitating disease in 40 years.
Which is terrifying.
Right. But the test comes with this massive caveat. They will only get the disease if they live in a certain environment, eat a very specific diet, and experience precise cellular changes over the next four decades. So what really happens when we start predicting the future like that?
We are looking at the absolute definition of diagnostic muddy waters. The foundational premise of genomics is that having a specific genetic variant does not automatically mean you are destined to actually manifest the disease.
Yeah, and before we get too deep, today we celebrate the work of the UK FRD Plus Gene Consortium, who advanced our understanding of what these programs actually deliver.
Yes, they published a brilliant meeting report in the European Journal of Human Genetics, looking at the actual tangible value of these massive, large-scale genomic programs.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because we constantly see these massive multi-million dollar headlines about how genome sequencing is revolutionizing medicine. Entire nations are betting their public healthcare budgets on this data.
They are. Germany has GenomeDE, France has their plan Medicine Genomique 2025, and there's Genomics England.
Right. But we have to cut through that PR hype and ask, what is the actual value? And this consortium evaluated the true impact across five distinct levels: societal, economic, clinical, scientific, and population-wide.
What's fascinating here is how incredibly difficult it is to systematically define, let alone measure, a benefit in this field. We always assume more data equals better health.
Naturally, yeah.
But analyzing the actual value requires looking past the technological optimism, you know, examining the hard, often uncomfortable data about how these programs function in the real world.
And before we can even touch the scientific breakthroughs or the clinical outcomes, we have to start at the absolute foundation, which is the societal level.
The societal trust fall.
Exactly. None of these national databases exist unless everyday citizens agree to hand over the most intimate, unchangeable biological data they possess. It is a massive societal trust fall.
That trust is the currency of genomic research. If a public healthcare system wants to build a database powerful enough to recognize complex genetic patterns, they need millions of participants, not just a few thousand. But the researchers point out a crucial paradigm shift. Governing bodies shouldn't view public distrust as a PR problem to be, you know, managed or smoothed over.
Like just running better ad campaigns.
Exactly. Distrust is a vital diagnostic signal in itself. It highlights precisely where the ethical guardrails are failing, particularly regarding public-private partnerships.
Which is the exact friction point for most people. Mm. I mean, people might inherently trust their national healthcare provider, but they get highly suspicious when private, for-profit, pharmaceutical, or tech companies are granted access to that publicly collected data.
Oh, absolutely.
It feels less like public health and more like data mining.
And citizens are right to demand transparency there. They want to know the mechanics of the benefit sharing.
Meaning who actually profits.
Right. If a private company uses a public genomic database to develop a blockbuster drug, does the public healthcare system get a discount on that drug? Or is the public essentially subsidizing corporate R&D with their biological data?
Wow. Yeah. When you put it like that, if the public feels commodified, participation just plummets.
It drops to zero.
The paper brings up a really compelling real-world example of testing these ethical boundaries, which is the Genomics England Generation Study. And this isn't just swabbing adults. They are aiming to sequence the whole genomes of 100,000 newborn babies.
A massive undertaking.
Huge. To screen for over 200 genetic conditions, running alongside the traditional heel-prick blood test.
And we should clarify, the traditional biochemical screening is looking for diseases that are actively happening right now in the infant. The generation study represents a shift from diagnosing the present to predicting the future.
Right. They want to see if whole genome sequencing can catch these conditions before any biochemical markers even appear.
Yes.
But testing babies brings up massive ethical dilemmas. I mean, it's like being handed a crystal ball for your baby's health, but the glass is super cloudy.
That's a great way to put it.
You're told your child has a marker for a severe disease. But because of how genetics actually work, that disease might never manifest. You blur the lines between providing immediate health care and conscripting a child into a lifetime of open-ended research.
To understand why that crystal ball is so cloudy, we have to look at the mechanisms of gene expression, specifically a concept called penetrance.
Okay. Break that down for us.
Well, a genetic variant does not act in a vacuum. Whether a gene actually turns on depends on incredibly complex epigenetic factors.
Let's define epigenetics for a second, because that's the key to all of this. It's essentially the software running your genetic hardware.
Yeah, like that, yes.
You might possess the gene for a condition, but environmental factors, things like maternal diet, exposure to toxins, or even childhood stress, can attach chemical tags to your DNA that physically block your body from reading that specific gene.
That is an excellent analogy. The sequence of the DNA hasn't changed at all, but its expression is altered by the environment. Because of those epigenetic variables, the ability of a single genetic variant to definitively predict a complex disease decades in advance is often surprisingly low.
And think about the agonizing stress that places on a family. You have a child with a genetic prediction, so they require regular, intense medical surveillance.
Every cough, every stumble becomes a potential symptom.
Exactly. It's a looming genetic shadow. We are essentially medicalizing perfectly healthy children.
Furthermore, we must look at the macro level resource allocation here. If a public healthcare system is spending vast amounts of money running lifelong surveillance on healthy children who merely possess a genetic risk factor, does that siphon resources away from marginalized groups who are already visibly acutely ill?
Which leads directly into the second dimension, the consortium analyzed the economic level.
Yeah.
Because if society does buy in and people donate their data, someone still has to balance the national budget.
Right, it isn't free.
We have to pay for the sequencing machines, the massive server farms to store petabytes of data, and the armies of specialists required to analyze it all.
And the shocking reality highlighted in the report is that there is a severe systemic lack of evidence regarding the broad economic value of these large-scale sequencing programs.
Wait, really? We don't know if it's worth the money.
We are building the infrastructure before we know if we can afford the maintenance. There is shockingly little economic data backing this up at a population scale.
Let me push back on that, though. I want to put on my patient advocate hat for a second. If a family is trapped in a diagnostic odyssey for a rare disease, spending years bouncing between specialists, undergoing painful biopsies, and spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on dead-end tests, finding an answer through one genome sequence is priceless.
It absolutely is for that family.
So why are we nickel and diamond genetic testing? Isn't ending that suffering worth whatever it costs?
The relief of ending a diagnostic odyssey is profound. And for rare single-gene disorders, sequencing is incredibly effective. But healthcare economics cannot operate on emotion alone. It operates on finite resources.
Right.
When a government funds a massive population-wide genomics program, they are pulling from a limited pool. If we overinvest in genomic screening for the healthy population without proving its cost utility, a government might be forced to defund proven, highly effective public health programs.
Like what?
Like childhood vaccination campaigns or diabetes prevention, just to balance the ledger.
Ah, I see. So it's not just about what the sequencing costs, it's about the opportunity cost of what we earn funding.
Precisely. And the consortium points to a powerful cautionary tale regarding this exact issue, which is Denmark.
What happened to Denmark?
Well, Denmark possesses a highly digitized healthcare system, but it is structurally decentralized across national, regional, and local municipalities.
Okay, so the regions are managing the actual day-to-day care, while the national government is trying to look at the big picture.
Right. When Denmark rolled out their national program for whole genome sequencing, they prioritized clinical speed. They wanted the technology in the hands of doctors and patients immediately.
Which sounds like a good thing.
It does. So the regional hospitals started sequencing. But because they didn't simultaneously establish the centralized data pathways to evaluate the economic impact of that sequencing, they are now flying blind.
Wait, how does a highly digitized system fly blind? Don't they have the data on whether the sequencing saved money by preventing later hospitalizations?
They have the data, but it is entirely siloed. The economic data, the cost of the follow-up appointments, the incidental findings, the long-term outcomes, it's all stuck in individual regional electronic health records.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it is not flowing back into the national health registries in a standardized format. Without that aggregated economic evidence, proving to policymakers that the program is financially sustainable over the next decade becomes nearly impossible. Denmark prioritized the clinical rollout but skipped the economic framework, and now they are struggling to justify the long-term investment.
That structural failure in Denmark perfectly sets up the third level of the report, which is the reality of the clinic. Because that disconnect doesn't just hurt the national budget, it directly impacts the physician trying to interpret a genome for the patient sitting right there on the examination table.
The clinical experience of genomic medicine is currently a landscape of extremes. As you mentioned earlier, receiving a molecular diagnosis through a service like the NHS Genomic Medicine Service can be transformative.
Right.
It can guide reproductive family planning, and in some specific cancers or rare diseases, it immediately dictates a highly targeted, effective therapy.
But the report clearly states that for the vast majority of patients, the test comes back without a definitive, actionable answer. You go through the entire sequencing process, you get a name for the genetic variant, and then the doctor tells you there is absolutely no treatment available. You basically reach the center of the maze, only to find a brick wall.
And that is where the psychological complexity of genomic medicine truly begins.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The researchers looked at the coping mechanisms patients use when they hit that brick wall. You would think an inconclusive result would be devastating.
You would.
But a lot of patients actually find deep comfort in the very fact that they are part of a long-term national research database. They understand that science is iterative, they know their data is sitting on a server, and as machine learning improves or new genes are discovered, researchers might revisit their genome in 5 years and finally unlock the answer.
That phenomenon highlights how hope is operationalized in clinical genomics. The report references a fascinating multi-site study from a large center for human genetics in Belgium. They investigated how clinical geneticists and laboratory professionals handle the massive amounts of ambiguous data.
The variants of unknown significance.
Exactly, because sequencing inevitably produces them.
And unlike our X-ray analogy from earlier, a variant of unknown significance is the ultimate gray area.
Yes. The Belgian study introduced a concept they term functional uncertainty. Medical professionals actually utilize the inherent murkiness of genomic data as an active clinical tool.
Wait, really?
Instead of delivering a flat, devastating negative result saying we found nothing and we can do nothing, they lean on their clinical intuition to frame the uncertainty as a temporary state. They frame it as we don't know yet.
So they are taking the fundamental flaw of the technology, its current inability to give a straight answer, and weaponizing it as an emotional cushion to keep the patient from falling into despair.
That's one way to look at it, yes.
But let me challenge that. Is that actually ethical? Is a doctor acting in the patient's best interest by keeping them on the hook? Or is this just a highly paternalistic way for the medical establishment to mask the fact that they oversold the capabilities of the technology?
This raises an important question regarding informed consent and transparency. Are we truly centering the patient's autonomy, allowing them to make clear-eyed decisions about their future? Or are we trapping them in a state of perpetual medical waiting?
It's a fine line.
It is. If functional uncertainty is used to manage expectations, doctors must be incredibly careful not to cross the line into false hope.
Which naturally brings us to the fourth level.
Yeah.
The scientific reality versus the hype. Why exactly is there so much uncertainty? I mean, we mapped the human genome over 2 decades ago. Why doesn't a DNA test give us a straight answer for the diseases that actually kill the majority of people, like heart disease or cancer?
To understand the scientific limitation, we have to examine polygenic risk scores, or PRS. This is currently one of the most heavily hyped concepts in commercial and clinical genomics.
Okay.
A single gene rarely causes a common disease. Instead, a polygenic risk score aggregates thousands or even millions of tiny genetic variations across your entire genome, calculates the tiny statistical weight of each one, and spits out an overall risk percentage for a disease like coronary artery disease.
But wait, if I get a polygenic risk score that says I am in the top 90th percentile for heart disease risk, that score is mathematically blind to my actual life, isn't it?
Entirely blind.
Because the science shows that for most common diseases, genetics only accounts for roughly 20 to 40% of the total risk. The other 60 to 80% is entirely dictated by my environment, my lifestyle, and social determinants.
That is the crucial blind spot. The genetic score does not know if you smoke a pack of cigarettes a day or if you run marathons and eat a Mediterranean diet.
It's like getting a weather forecast for a month from now. The incredibly sophisticated atmospheric model tells you there's a 30% chance of rain on a specific Tuesday.
Right.
But you still have to look out the window on the actual morning to see if you need an umbrella, because 70% of what actually happens is going to be based on local, immediate pressure systems that the long-term model couldn't possibly account for.
And relying exclusively on that 30% genetic forecast poses severe real-world dangers. If we integrate polygenic risk scores into routine primary care, without heavy caveats, we risk massive overdiagnosis.
Like treating things that were never going to be an issue.
Exactly. A patient might be put through invasive, stressful, and expensive preventative procedures for a cancer they were never actually going to develop because their protective lifestyle factors weren't calculated in the score.
Wow.
And conversely, we risk false reassurance. A patient with a low genetic risk score for diabetes might completely ignore their diet and skip routine blood work, believing they are genetically immune.
So how do we fix that at the scientific level? How do we stop doctors from overinterpreting this data when the patient is sitting right there demanding action based on a high score?
The consortium report points to structural, multidisciplinary solutions, specifically highlighting the framework developed by the European Society for Medical Oncology, or ESMO. They recognize that a single physician should not be interpreting complex genomic data in isolation.
So they use a team approach?
Yes, through specialized advisory boards, often called molecular tumor boards. You put oncologists, clinical geneticists, bioinformaticians, and ethicists all in the same room.
That sounds intense.
It is necessary. Before a genomic finding is ever communicated to the patient as actionable, this multidisciplinary board debates the variant. They look at the allele frequency, they weigh it against the patient's environmental factors, and they require a consensus.
So it's a safeguard.
Exactly. This framework acts as a circuit breaker, stopping the hype of a new genetic variant from translating into unnecessary and potentially harmful overtreatment.
We have to mandate reality checks before the data reaches the prescription pad. That makes total sense for an individual hospital. But let's scale that up to the final level the consortium analyzed, the population puzzle.
The biggest challenge of all.
Right. Because if the science is still playing catch up for the individual and requires a room full of experts just to interpret one variant, what happens when a government tries to apply this to an entire country?
We run headfirst into the immense logistical and ethical challenge of precision public health. Traditionally, public health is a blunt instrument designed for maximum coverage. You implement seatbelt laws, you mandate clean water standards, you tax tobacco.
Universal rules.
Yes. These broad, universal interventions rely on a one-size-fits-all philosophy to protect the vast majority. Genomic medicine is the exact philosophical opposite. It is hyper-individualized, tailored to the unique molecular makeup of a single person.
And right now, the blunt instruments are still vastly more effective. A person's zip code, their access to fresh food, and their housing stability play a much larger role in their overall health than their genomic sequence.
Without a doubt.
If a national healthcare system diverts its focus away from fixing food deserts and instead focuses on hyper-personalized medicine, precision public health programs are going to completely leave behind minority, rural, and marginalized groups.
That is the great paradox of genomic medicine. It is hailed as a universal equalizer, but practically, marginalized populations are far less likely to participate in the research cohorts.
Which means the data is skewed.
Exactly, meaning the algorithms and risk scores are primarily calibrated on data from wealthy, predominantly European descent populations. If we apply those biased algorithms at a population level, we don't just maintain the existing health gap, we exponentially widen it.
And we can see this tension playing out at the highest levels of national policy. The report specifically dissects France's plan Medicine Genomique 2025.
A very ambitious plan.
Very. But when you read their public charters, they explicitly promise equity. They promise justice and democratic equal access to genomic healthcare for all French citizens. But in the exact same breath, the plan heavily emphasizes global economic competitiveness, driving technological innovation, and accelerating the domestic bio industry.
Those are fundamentally competing priorities. This raises an important question. What happens when a nation's drive for scientific prestige and economic dominance begins to overshadow its mandate to provide equitable care?
Something has to give.
Right. If a program is pressured to show immediate economic returns and rapid industry acceleration, it will inevitably prioritize the low-hanging fruit. It will sequence the most accessible, wealthy populations who already interact heavily with the healthcare system, while the costly, slow work of building trust and access in vulnerable communities is pushed to the margins.
It essentially becomes an industrial project wearing a public health trench coat.
That is a very apt description.
But the report does outline some pilot attempts to measure and correct this, though, right? They mention a framework called the PLUTO tool.
Yes. PLUTO stands for Public Value Assessment Tool. It is an attempt to quantify what we discussed at the very beginning, how do we measure true benefit.
Right.
PLUTO is a framework designed to assess the actual public value generated when a specific entity requests to use national genomic data.
But how does it actually score that? You can't just put public good into a spreadsheet.
It attempts to break the usage down into tangible, measurable metrics across three pillars: environmental, economic, and societal.
Okay, give me an example.
For example, if a pharmaceutical company requests access to the database, PLUTO asks, does this specific data usage reduce healthcare waste or carbon footprint? Does it stimulate local economic growth rather than just offshoring profits? And crucially, does the research explicitly target underrepresented demographics to improve societal equity?
It forces a rigorous accounting of value beyond just clinical curiosity.
Exactly. Whether tools like PLUTO can effectively capture all the messy nuances of genomics is still being studied, but it represents a vital shift from assuming data is inherently good to demanding proof of its public utility.
So what does this all mean? What does this mean for the listener at home? We started by looking at the towering, almost utopian promises of genetic medicine. But by filtering those promises through the UK FRD plus Gene Consortium's report, the reality is far more demanding.
If we synthesize their findings, the roadmap for a successful, sustainable genomic future is incredibly strict. First, the scientific community must immediately cease overpromising. We need a balanced, transparent discourse on the limitations of epigenetic penetrance. Second, governments must mandate concrete economic frameworks like the ones missing in Denmark before writing blank checks for national sequencing. Third, we need structural circuit breakers like the ESMO advisory boards to manage the clinical and psychological uncertainty patients face. And finally, these programs must prove their public value through tools like PLUTO, prioritizing marginalized groups from day one rather than treating equity as an afterthought to industrial expansion.
It's about ensuring the infrastructure actually serves the patient, not just the data industry. We've spent a lot of time today talking about how your personal biological data builds the foundation for the entire future of global medicine. But it leaves you with something profound to consider.
Yeah, it really does.
If your genome is no longer just yours, if it is a shared public resource being utilized to balance national healthcare budgets, train private algorithms, and drive global scientific prestige, how much of your own biological future are you willing to uncover, knowing that your cloudy crystal ball might be the exact data point required to save a stranger tomorrow?
It's a heavy question.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
We lit the lab with midnight screams, a million letters in between. We hoped the code would tell it straight, but most predictions learn to wait.